Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What sort of life did Anne Frank and her family have before they were forced to disappear in a desperate effort to evade capture by the Nazis? Anne's famous diary has allowed millions of readers to imagine the Franks' 2 years in hiding above an Amsterdam warehouse. But a traveling exhibition of family photographs taken in better times reminds us that the Franks were not simply book characters, but real people who had known the pleasures of long walks and birthday parties and trips to the beach. You can see dozens of these images in the exhibition Anne Frank, A Private Photo Album, which is on display at the Dallas Holocaust Museum through March 31st. Joining us to talk about it are Sarah Abosh, Senior Director of Education for the Museum, and Charlotte DeCoster, who works as its Education and Public Engagement Coordinator. Welcome, both of you, to Think.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us today.
The exhibition has been traveling all over the world for several years now. What did it take to bring it to the Dallas Holocaust Museum, and what was the thinking, what is the thinking about its value in educating people, not just about the Frank family, but about the Holocaust in general?
It took a lot of programming and planning on our part. We tend to try and find exhibits that will not only appeal to the general public, but will specifically appeal to the school age population. We have over 30,000 school children from the greater Metroplex area come in every year. And we know that they mostly read Anne Frank anywhere from fourth grade into high school. They read the diary. And so we were really looking to bring something in relating to Anne Frank, but something that was really special and different. And the other thing I would say, and this is something that I would address to Charlotte, is that it deals with child rescue, which is not all that well known in the public. And this particular aspect doesn't, but Charlotte is an expert on that area, so I'll send that to her.
Yeah, this exhibit, the reason for it coming in was very important, is because it shows a little bit not only the life of Anne Frank as we get it in the diary, which is already in hiding most of the time. But we see a little bit of a glimpse into the Frank family before they went into hiding. And it shows the happy time that this family had before all the horrible events that occurred during the Holocaust occurred to this family as well. So it's a little bit a dual. You can have the diary, which we have available in the exhibit, but you can also view the life before. And I think that's so important, is to sometimes view life before we read a book or be able to take a glimpse, especially if that person's not here anymore to tell the rest of their story.
There's one other thing that as I'm listening to Charlotte speak, that I really love about the exhibit. There's a montage of probably a dozen photos at least. And what they are is they're school photos of Margot Frank and Anne Frank. And when school children come through the museum, they really kind of hone in on this and focus. And
it's like my school picture.
Exactly.
Is what they're thinking. Yeah.
And sometimes they look wonderful, and sometimes Anne had bad hair days too. And it's so funny to see the school children look at this, and it humanizes an event that's just vast. And it brings it down to a level that's really very comprehensible for school children. And I think that that's a unique thing about this particular exhibit.
Yeah, I think I related to it on that level. And you know, we all, I think, in this room obviously read The Diary of Anne Frank first as children. And then you think, what an amazing person. And she becomes so much larger than life given this experience. And it's understandable why that happens. But it almost takes away from our ability to relate, because she seems so special and so strong, that suddenly seeing that she was a normal person, that the picture that we were talking about before the show, there's just a great photo of the Frank girls standing at the beach, and their backs are to the camera and they're looking out on the ocean. I have four kids and we have got the exact same picture of our children, and that one just struck me, because in that shot, they really don't have a sense, especially the children don't at that point, of what's ahead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when I actually tour students through the museum, I actually, before I walk into the exhibit, I tell them, close your eyes. And now think of your own family photo album and open it up, and you know, with your eyes closed, open up this album. What do you see in there? You see baby pictures. You see your school pictures. You see vacation pictures. You see holiday pictures. And then I say, okay, open up your eyes, and now you're going to walk into this exhibit. And that's what you're going to see. You're going to see very similar to your family pictures. You're going to see these pictures again, but then these are going to be the Frank family. And that's what, when you walk through, you really get the feeling that you're almost walking into a part that could be your life too. It is those school pictures, the baby pictures. I always laugh when I say, notice how there's more pictures of Margot in this exhibit than Anne. And I ask school children, why do you think there are more pictures of Margot? And they think and they look at me and then always the ones that are the second child in the family, they start, we know, because there's always more pictures of the older child. Mm-hmm. So, and it's little things like that that makes the exhibit so special, is that you can relate, like you said, so close to it.
And so it was Otto Frank, the girl's father, who was really the shutterbug in mm-hmm. the family. And how creative did he get? What, you know, what sorts of ideas did he have about the pictures he was taking?
He was actually quite creative because and this is something that Charlotte and I point out when we take school children through the exhibit, is that he didn't have a little cell phone or a point and click. Right. I mean, these were large cameras. Mm-hmm. He had to think consciously about it, load it with film, and really haul it around with him when he went. And the photos are simply of the girls and occasionally the nanny or the nurse and the girl's mother. He doesn't appear in any of the photos except in shadow. Mm-hmm. And even that has to be a conscious choice because he's clearly the one who's setting the shots up in many ways. So he is in some of these photos as the shadow that kind of falls to the side of the girls or behind the girls. So I think that probably even though they're not posed photos in many ways, he had to have been thinking about what he wanted in terms of shot angles and how to actually take these to have them look as natural as they look, because it's not an easy thing to do using the equipment that he had.
There's a sort of a poetic irony in that he appears only in shadow, and he was, in fact, the only member of the family to survive the Holocaust. And I remember the first time I read the diary, and then someone gave me a timeline, and I was struck by how close they came to making it through the war without being captured, and then to making it through this horrifying experience in the death camps. Anne and Margot, as I understand it, died just weeks before their camp was liberated.
Yeah, that's actually the unfortunate part. And this is actually the part of the Frank family stories that is very similar to a lot of other Holocaust victims, is that many of them died days, weeks before they were liberated in the concentration camps or the death camps in Poland. And that's the unfortunate part, is we either recognize the survivors of those who died in the extermination camps and the death camps by the gas chamber, but we forget all those victims that passed away in concentration camps by disease, such as the Frank sisters, execution there, famine. And that's the story that oftentimes doesn't get told, because we focus on maybe the extreme points and not on the other, maybe not as extreme ways that victims during the Holocaust passed away.
Mm-hmm. You know, the other part of this is that there were people who made it through to liberation and then still died.
Yeah.
Because they're, you know, typhus, dysentery, malnutrition. These were rampant in the camps, and you're in such a weakened state, TB. So they simply didn't have the internal physical resources, even after liberation, with, you know, food and medicine coming in to survive. And so for months after the liberation of the concentration camps and the death camps, there are still people who are passing away. So it's, yeah, it's very sad.
I can actually relate a personal story to that. Yeah. My grandfather was a medical doctor. He finished his medical studies during the war. I'm originally from Belgium. I grew up there, and my whole family still lives there. So when the British military liberated Belgium, he joined the British military and actually moved into Germany with them and was there upon the liberation of Bergen-Belsen. And as a medical doctor, remained there for 2 years. And my grandfather, unfortunately, had Alzheimer's at a very young age, so I didn't know him very well. But in his notes that he left behind, he does account for 2 years after the war. Hmm. We don't have the exact date that he wrote down in his diary that's the first time he got really, really drunk. And my mother always told me he never drank much, but that's a story she remembers, is because that's the first day they did not have a survivor pass away.
Wow.
Of the people in the camp. And so I always think that's, we forget about that 2 year period that they still had to help people survive. It doesn't end in May 1945 when the war is over. No, it's 2 more years that medical staff then has to care for these people, and then still a lot of them not survive, and that's a little bit devastating part of it, is reaching liberation and then still having to fight through it.
I have to wonder, too, about grief. You think about Otto Frank making it through, going back to Amsterdam, finding the family that had helped to shelter him, and hoping for a while that others in the family would turn up. Can you talk about the process by which survivors tried to gather information in the immediate aftermath of the end of the war, and the channels through which that information came, both officially and unofficially?
Yeah, there's numerous channels, and some of these they pursued on their own, individual survivors. Some of these were done via government or non-governmental organizations, NGOs. So just as a sample, we have a board member at the museum, a gentleman named Charles Teichman. He was born right after the war, but his parents both survived the war in France. His father came from a large family of 10 children, and his father, when he got back to France after the war, put ads in newspapers that ran in DP camps, in displaced persons camps, where refugees who couldn't go home were located. He found his one surviving brother, wrote to the brother and asked him to come and live with them in France. The brother said, I need to go back to Poland first and see if I can find the rest of the family. So this was through unofficial channels, obviously. Went back to Poland, to the little town that they were from, and was murdered by his neighbors when he showed up because they thought he was coming to reclaim the small farm property that they had. Hmm. So that's one example. People went through the American Joint Distribution the Joint Committee looking for family. They went through the Israeli, it would have been the Palestine government, the Jewish Agency, subsequently through the Israeli government. I'm not sure about the mechanisms within European governments, but
yes.
You know.
Several European governments, for example, the Dutch government set up what they called transit stations. They were usually in the large cities such as Amsterdam, Brussels, Paris, especially for Western Europe. Basically stations, if they arrived there was a contact person there, a desk that they could go to, an information desk, and survivors could go there and then list their name, and through they basically made lists every day of people who were returning from the camps. And actually, if you read Miep Gies Remembered, Miep Gies was the person who helped the Frank family
food
put them in hiding. Her husband, Hank, who was very influential too in helping the family go into hiding, he worked in Amsterdam at that desk. And every day he would go, he requested that job because he wanted to know the moment Otto Frank returned, or if any of the girls returned, because at that point they didn't know. So he was one of the first ones of the rescuers to find out that Edith Frank had passed away, because another survivor had come back from Auschwitz, and that's how they found out that Edith had passed away. And he also heard from another survivor that Otto had survived, that they had seen Otto somewhere else. So they knew Otto was going to return. And then they tried to, from survivors as much, to get information about Anne and Margot. And then Otto Frank returned, and he was there. He heard it in the station. He knew Otto Frank was going to arrive on that train, because survivors on the train before him had told him that Otto would be on the next train. Mm. So he ran home to Miep, telling Miep Otto is going to arrive. And as he's telling her, Otto Frank was literally walking down the street to their house. So all different kinds of way of finding people back.
My guests this hour are Charlotte DeCoster, Education and Public Engagement Coordinator for the Dallas Holocaust Museum, and Sarah Abosh, who is Senior Director of Education for the museum. The exhibition Anne Frank, A Private Photo Album, is on display there through March 31st. You can find information at dallasholocaustmuseum.org. If you'd like to join the conversation, we do have phone lines open now. The number is 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for THINK comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. New spring semester personal enrichment and professional development courses are now open and available for registration. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Anne Frank, A Private Photo Album, is an exhibition on display at the Dallas Holocaust Museum through March 31st. We have two experts here from the museum talking about it and about the Holocaust. Sarah Abosh is Senior Director of Education. Charlotte DeCoster is Education and Public Engagement Coordinator. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. One thing that is also striking about these images is, if I'm correct, they are taken from albums that the family actually brought with them to the annex when they went into hiding. And it makes perfect sense, of course, that of all that, you can only take a very few things, but of course you want your family pictures. Did Otto Frank think early on, at the time he was publishing Anne's journal or looking to get it published, that he would also make the photographs available?
No, he didn't. And in fact, this is a really fascinating part of the story. They didn't recover these albums during Otto Frank's lifetime. He passed away in 1980, and these albums showed up in the early 1990s on the front steps of the Anne Frank House in Amsterdam. One morning, they opened the door, and there they were in an unmarked box. They had been hidden in a couch in the annex, and when the family had been betrayed and taken off to Westerbork and then onward, the annex had been gutted and looted. And somebody looted the couch in which these had been hidden, and nobody ever assumed that they would see them again, and there they were. So he, in fact, didn't know that they still existed at the time of his death.
Wow.
Yeah.
So how were decisions made by the people who originally curated the exhibition about which, because it's like 400 photographs in total, right, and 70 are in the exhibition?
These are the ones that came primarily from the private albums themselves. There's many more pictures, of course, in albums from other people that had pictures of the Frank family. Mm-hmm. These particularly are from the pictures that Otto took. And so they divided that already out. It was just the private Frank album. And then from those, they took basically a collection of those that stood out that were memorable, baby pictures, school pictures, vacation pictures, to portray an overall view of the Frank family before they went into hiding, with the focus on Anne, of course.
How were they captioned in the family's albums?
They're, as far as I know, they weren't captioned. Are you aware of them having been captioned, Charlotte?
They had little text in the...
Weren't those what Anne herself put in?
No, Edith Frank put the actual text in. So if you go through our exhibit, you'll see little text under each picture. And that's the text that Edith put in the albums. Like we would scrapbooking, mm-hmm. say, you know, this is our vacation trip to Colorado, for example. This was vacation to Switzerland. This was vacation on the beach. And then she would write under there. Anne was in a goofy mood that day. And so the comments that you see on the panels in our exhibit are the comments written by Edith Frank. Or afterwards, there's a few where Otto Frank explained what the picture is showing. But mainly it is Edith writing the notes in there.
Didn't they also find some of those photos in Anne's journal that she had pulled and illustrated sections in her journal with?
Yes, those pictures are not in our exhibit, but those are the ones that can be widely found online that might look similar to our pictures in our exhibit, because Anne did pull pictures out of these photo albums and put them in her diary and make comments. And actually, if you grab the short version of the diary, the most popular published copy of it, the first few pages, it has those pictures in it and the comments that Anne wrote on there. And if you go through our exhibit, you'll notice that some of those pictures look very similar to the pictures in our exhibit, because they're, for example, school pictures that there were duplicates of that were in the photo album that Anne took out. So you'll recognize some of the images, especially the one of Anne sitting at the desk at school. That one is in there. It's in our exhibit as well. If you would put those pictures next to each other, you would see a difference. But there is similar pictures out there of the ones we have in our exhibit.
I have read that Otto Frank said he didn't, when he read Anne's journal for the first time, he he was struck by what was in it and how deep her emotions had been. Can you elaborate a little bit on what he said about his emotional experience the first time that he went through this record of the life of his younger daughter?
He comments on the fact that there was depth there that he simply hadn't anticipated, that he thought that she was much kind of lighter, sprightlier. I don't know quite how to phrase that, she was his younger daughter, and he simply wasn't aware of the fact that she wasn't – not just that she was experiencing these emotional depths, but that she was able in a very mature way to comment upon what she was going through and really to discuss it in depth. And I think that really surprised him.
It makes sense that at the ages the girls were, they understood everything, but maybe they were still young enough that everybody tried to sort of keep things optimistic when they talked about it. I mean, do we know?
We know very little of how Anne and Margot viewed it, mm-hmm. because we don't have their story of afterwards. But from Meep Geese is the one who would spend the night there or would ever go into the annex. And she really sees it that the girls were very aware, and as time went on, because we're talking about 2 years yeah. and 2 months, that's a long time living in a small apartment, that you could see the wear and tear on him of living inside and that the realization is setting in. And I think from Anne's diary, you can also the way she talks about the world, the way she sees other people, not only people close to her, but the world population in general, and the belief in good and bad and, you know, good versus evil. I think that just shows how much those girls realized, and she was the youngest one in the annex, so the children really knew what was going on. And you know, Otto Frank tracked the movement of the American army through France, and he talked about the concentration camps and the camps of the information he had. They listened to BBC radio.
They had a radio with mm-hmm. them, so
that, you know, they did actually know a lot of what was going on.
A few years ago, I was in Amsterdam and I visited the Anne Frank House, and I had read the diary multiple times. I had seen the movie versions. I had seen the stage play. The thing that I didn't get until I went in there was that it was dark all the time. There was never any natural light coming into that space. And I wonder if you can talk about that and about the... We just need natural light to feel normal.
Yeah. And they were very aware of it. They had windows that faced the back. And this had to be, if anybody was even aware that there was a space here from the outside, they had to look at it from outside and just think that it was part of the warehouse. Mm-hmm. And so there simply couldn't be any kind of light source coming in, because that would possibly show movement and show that there were people in the back of this area, and this was supposed to simply be storage for boxes and things like that. And you're right. I mean, it's grim. And myself, I've often wondered if some of that didn't drive Anne to be more of a diarist. I mean, there were her interests in being known after the war as well, but simply that this was one outlet for her musings and her imaginings, because she simply didn't have the outside coming in on that level.
And again, I think it was seeing them living their lives before the war in yeah. these photographs is such a striking contrast to yeah. what they lived through for those 2 years and 2 months before they were captured. We do sometimes, it's easy to forget that the Frank family was not the only family that was in hiding, that mm-hmm. either survived the war or didn't, but spent a significant portion of it being concealed. What do we know about the numbers of people, Jews in particular, who at least for part of the war tried to hide to evade capture?
Well, it's very difficult to say the exact numbers. We'll never have the exact numbers for two reasons. Is because the Frank family is unique. Most Jews did not hit as a family. Most of the time, the children were separated mm-hmm. from their parents. And when you talk about hidden children, and especially Jewish children, they were hiding in Catholic orphanages, in Protestant institutions in the Netherlands, with other families. But most of the time, they were not hiding with their family. in addition, most of them were not hiding in the middle of the city. They were hiding in the countryside. They had to move around several times. It's very rare that you see them hiding in one location and remaining in that one location throughout the whole war. So the Frank family's experience was very unique in that matter. But we can talk for Western Europe. The numbers for Eastern Europe are a little lower because percentage-wise they're lower because it was much more difficult to hide there. The Germans were much more aggressive in their persecution there, and there was little aid from the Polish population, Hungarian population, whereas in Western Europe, the Dutch, French, and Belgians actually did help a lot and tried to assist. Many tried to assist the Jews in going into hiding. There was large networks built to place children in hiding of all different organizations that were independent from each other. And these organizations accomplished hiding tens of thousands of children. Were in Netherlands, probably around 5,000 children were hidden, probably around close to 7,000-8,000 for Belgium, and then we're easily talking 10,000-20,000 in France. So there was a massive underground movement in placing children in hiding. For adults, it became more difficult. Just think about it yourself. It's easier to take a child into hiding. Just the emotional link alone is a little easier than an adult standing on your doorstep and danger with it. The danger is overcome a little bit when it's a cute little girl with a bow in her hair instead of an adult. So for adults, it was a little bit more difficult. And that's why it was extremely difficult to hide as a family. Thousands of Jews did go in hiding. Most of them went into hiding around 1942. This is when deportation, especially during the summer, actively started in Western Europe. Again, this is when the Frank family goes into hiding as well, when Margot gets the notice for deportation. So that is similar. We see the same movement in other families, is that that's when they decide to give up their children. And most of them either decided it in that summer of 1942 and had start making preparations, or they decided to keep their children and not go into hiding and were deported. So it is that key decision point was definitely made in 1942, in that summer of 1942, for Western Europe. In Eastern Europe, it would be much earlier. We would be talking 1940, 1941.
Mm-hmm. The other thing is as far as Eastern Europe goes, as Charlotte noted, the locals were much, much more hostile, the Ukrainians, the Polish, the Belarusians.
Just because of an overriding culture of anti-Semitism?
A seriously overriding culture of anti-Semitism. And there are historical roots for this. So it's not as illogical as I think some people think it is. But having said that, it's much, much harder to hide. They were, for the large part, they were a poorer population, mm-hmm. And the surrounding peasantry was also poorer. The relations had been bad for a much, much longer period of time. They were overrun and killing squads, Einsatzgruppen, come in very, very quickly. There's more lag time in what's going on in the West, so you can begin to prepare for these kinds of things. There's a tremendous amount of time between when the Nazis, for example, invade Holland and when the Nazis begin roundups. There is no lag time. They invade the Soviet Union June 22nd, 1941. The killing squads are behind them. The shootings begin the end of the 22nd into the 23rd of June of 1941. It's that rapid and that fast. The other thing I would say is that in the East, you have some of the hiding being the same type of hiding. Some of the hiding is hiding in plain sight. And you see this in the West as well. Because they're little children, they're given a new identity as a Catholic child or a Protestant child, and they just join the family, and you know, we now have little Hans who's part of the family, mm-hmm. And so there's no hiding him behind closed doors, although some of that goes on also in the East, and you have some of this in the West, but less so. You have them hidden in holes in the ground. You have them hidden in barns. You have them hidden in outbuildings. We have stories from survivors, including local survivors who now live at Legacy up in Plano, who were hidden for more than a year underground, whose muscles atrophied to such an extent being in these little closed spaces that they had to be helped to learn to walk again after their time in hiding. I mean, so hiding wasn't necessarily as comfortable. That's an odd word to use. But Anne's hiding was in many ways much more comfortable than some of the other people's situations.
Well, even considering the stories of children who were hidden, say, in Catholic and Protestant boarding schools in Western Europe, who survived the war, in some ways we would consider them the fortunate ones. And in many ways they were, because they did survive physically unscathed. But the trauma of being marched into a place where everybody eats different foods and says different prayers and has different customs, and then somebody tells you, okay, your name is not Sarah anymore, you're to be called Marie or something, it has got to be really sort of, from a psychological standpoint, really, really difficult to deal with for a child.
Yeah, it really depended. When I was interviewing and when I was listening to interviews by these child survivors, especially in Belgium, on which I wrote my master's thesis, is that it really depended. When they were younger, say below the age of 8, a lot of them saw them as a new experiment, like a new...
An adventure.
An adventure to go through. When they were over 8, they really realized what was going on and it became much more difficult. They also had deeper roots in their own family's tradition. Even if they weren't practicing Jews, they still had affiliation to the community, and they realized the dangers that came with going into hiding. For the very little ones, it was easy to go into hiding, but then afterwards, they didn't know their parents. They didn't realize they were Jewish. So children that went into hiding when they were under 5, oftentimes 4 years later when parents returned, if they returned, they didn't know they had those parents. They didn't recognize those parents. Mm-hmm. And that's sometimes more difficult is than readjusting to going back into the Jewish community, maybe living with a Jewish aunt or uncle, going back to Jewish parents. And you can just imagine how some of these Jewish parents, if they came back from the East, from these death camps and concentration camps, all the psychological trauma they had to deal with, the way they looked. For a child, it's shocking that those are your parents.
Charlotte DeCoster and Sarah Abosh are here from the Dallas Holocaust Museum, which has the exhibition Anne Frank, A Private Photo Album, on display through March 31st. Welcome back to the conversation in a couple of minutes. You can join us on the phone at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. New spring semester personal enrichment and professional development courses are now open and available for registration. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guests this hour are Sarah Abosh, who is Senior Director of Education for the Dallas Holocaust Museum, and Charlotte DeCoster, Education and Public Engagement Coordinator for the Dallas Holocaust Museum. The exhibition Anne Frank, A Private Photo Album, is on display there through March 31st. You can find information at dallasholocaustmuseum.org. If you'd like to join the conversation, call us at 1-800-933-5372. Or email think@kera.org. That's where we hear from Katie, who writes, "What is the best way to preserve the stories of survivors? My elderly grandfather only recently began sharing his memories of his experience during that time period, and I would like to know the best way to document them. My very young family members will never hear those stories firsthand, and my fear is that their significance will be lost in the retelling."
Actually, we encourage all survivors and liberators as well, not just survivors, but to come to our museum. We have a extensive archive up there with items from the Holocaust that if survivors want to donate that or liberators want to donate their items, we take those in. We take very good care of them. We preserve them. Hopefully one day we can put those on display. But we also take testimonies. We interview the person. We have trained. We work with you. University of North Texas that sends trained interviewers over. I interview myself. I've been trained for taking oral testimonies as well. We put those on videotape because it's very important to preserve those stories. If a survivor is not able to come to us, we meet them. And there are still we have most testimonies of the Dallas Holocaust survivors that live in this area, but there are still out there some that we don't know about or that don't want to work with us. So if you are a family member of a survivor, we encourage them to talk about it. I know it's very difficult, but tell them that people need to hear their story, and we need to educate the public about the events that occurred in the Holocaust, and their story is the best way to educate people about it. So contact us at, go to our website, DallasHolocaustMuseum.org. You can find our archive and library information on there, and contact us, and we will help you with everything you need in regard to that.
Are there concerns about the moment when, and there's almost no way to phrase this question without sounding really morbid, but a lot of time has passed. At some point, the last survivor of the Holocaust will no longer be walking among us. And how the urgency of education changes, how the sense of contact with history changes for future generations.
It's a fascinating question, and it's a question that we've actually, Charlotte and I, have both gotten again and again. The answer I would give you is yes and no. Mm-hmm. And the reason I would say yes is we have had this incredible resource. We as Americans, we as Europeans, even we as, you know, Soviets, because testimonies have been taken, have been recorded on tape, on videotape, on digital recordings of many, many, many survivors. And I'm thinking of the, for example, the USC Shoah Foundation, which has 52,000 separate testimonies, all digitally preserved. Having said that, while that brings an immediacy to it, all things are fleeting. That's what it means to be human. And all things move into history. And when things move into history, they don't become any less real. And the perfect example of this, we're sitting here in Texas, and I used to teach in university in the South a lot. And the Civil War, when it comes up in class, is a very real, very ongoing, very current thing for many, many students and people who live here in the South and the Southwest. And yet it ended in 1865. Mm-hmm. So I would put to you that World War II, the Holocaust, the lessons of the Holocaust, learning about the Holocaust are simply not going to go away. It's going to make our task as historians, and Charlotte and I are both trained historians, more difficult because we're taking what is still a living and embodied by these survivors event, and we have to both gently keep their legacy and at the same time continue to make sure that it has historical resonance as they pass from the scene. But the story didn't not happen just because they're no longer with us.
Charlotte, I hesitate to put you in the position of representing all Europe with this answer, but maybe you can talk about, would you characterize the nature of ongoing Holocaust study and education in the United States as being fundamentally different from the scholarship and the education that's taking place in Europe these days?
No, it's actually not different at all, the education. Maybe different stresses in what topics that are studied, but Holocaust studies is making a huge revival. In Belgium, where I'm from, we just had a brand new Holocaust museum open. It was funded by the state. They put several millions of euros into building this new museum. It comes with a huge research center. They work together with the Catholic University in Belgium and with the university in Brussels. I know Amsterdam, the Anne Frank House, is sponsored by the government there as well. And there's several universities there that have active Holocaust studies programs, very similar to here in the United States, where Holocaust studies programs are popping up left and right, and more people are studying it as a philosophy topic, as a history topic, as a social studies topic. And that's very encouraging to see that this is a topic that scholars are interested in again. But not only scholars at a university level, but at lower levels too, high school, middle school. I think the U.S. is a little bit ahead than other countries, especially in Europe, teaching about the Holocaust at that level. But I hope that museums and archives and research centers, such as the one that was just created in Belgium, will encourage it at a high school level as well.
I would add, moving from academic to more general popular memorialization, that that's where the U.S. is really ahead. We have we're lucky to have 19 different museum centers in the United States, and Dallas is lucky to have its very own. Mm-hmm. Having said that, they're much more sparsely, so they tend to figure either at a camp or in a capital city in Europe. And the perfect example I just noticed on a Google alert this morning, that Italy is still years away from opening its first Holocaust museum. It's going to be opened in Benito Mussolini, the dictator's former villa mansion in Rome. But they still don't have one in Italy, for example. So on that level, we're slightly ahead of where Europe is.
I wonder if part of that is due to the fact that we are, to my knowledge, blessed in this country to have been able to have a number of survivors make their homes here, although we did not do a whole lot as a country to open our doors to them when things were very bad. But we don't have a lot of people who say, a lot of Americans who say, oh, my grandfather was a Nazi, you know, that sort of not so secret family shame of having been involved in this. Whereas it's something that a lot of European families, even as they struggle to sort of reconcile themselves to the events that took place, understand that they've got a familial connection to the brutality as well as to the victimization.
Well, I think actually in certain families that might be the case, but a lot of families, for example, in Western Europe and also in Eastern Europe, survived the brutality of the Germans that weren't Jewish, and they can in some way still relate to that, not to the extreme that the Jewish population went through, but in Belgium and France, there were a lot of resistance fighters, and they were put in concentration camps too. A lot of concentration camps were not built for Jews. They were built for resistance fighters. They were built for political prisoners. And I think those countries recognize that building a memorial to the Holocaust links the suffering not only of the Jews in those different countries, but also to the my grandparents, in my case, or their parents. I go and visit the concentration camp in Belgium whenever I have a chance, whenever I go back home, to pay respect to my family members that were interned there. And it's very close to the Jewish deportation camp where the Jewish Holocaust Museum is. So I visit that as well. And I think a lot of people there make that link. And I think that's what drives it more than the guilt. Mm-hmm. In Germany, it's a very different story. I think there, the idea of talking about reparations is very different. I think each country in Europe is a little different. It's not like we can compare it to the United States and more see it as a block.
Right.
In Europe, it's Austria is reacting very different than Germany. Hungary is going through this almost counter, very anti-Semitic movement right now. So that's why it's difficult to say we'll take Europe as one block, mm-hmm. and say, Belgium, France, and the Netherlands, I think, can be compared more to each other than Germany, Austria, Hungary, Romania.
Yeah.
I think part of it has to do with, as Charlotte just mentioned, that there's ongoing anti-Semitism in Europe. It's flared up tremendously in Hungary, as she noticed. There are instances all over the former Soviet Union. There's flare-ups now in France. It has become very, very difficult for Jews in France. There are even flare-ups outside of London in many of the surrounding areas. And in talking about Britain, that kind of serves as the counterexample to what you were just questioning, Chris, because in Britain, they have survivors, but they have very few atrocity committers. Mm-hmm. I mean, that just isn't the nature of the British history. Yet Britain doesn't start to really put together memorialization of the Holocaust and their committees to begin doing this on a nationwide scale until 2000. That's the year that they begin to organize on the nationwide level. So I think that there may be something to be said for American notions of acceptance, you know, accepting those around you and tolerance. And it may have something to do, frankly, with the civil rights movement that we came through here and some of our own history in the United States and our history in terms of our civil rights record, good and bad, because we have to recognize both sides of it, is very, very different from Europe's that way. And I think that that contributes to this on some level as well.
Many young people in this country will sort of really deeply engage with the story of the Holocaust first through the Diary of Anne Frank, although there's some really good literature now being written for even younger children. But I wonder where you send them next when they say, I read this, I'm interested, I want to know more. What are the next books? What are the next films? What are the next museum exhibits that you encourage people to seek out?
There are so many choices and there's so many resources available. On Anne Frank alone, I always recommend if you're in the topic of Anne Frank itself, I read Anne Frank Remembered. It's Miep Gies' story. There are several works out there on Otto Frank as well, on his life afterwards and the legacy. There are several stories of people who knew Anne Frank that survived the Holocaust that you can read. But then the wide array goes out. If you're from Dallas and you want to read more on survivors that live in Dallas currently, we have some great works in our museum itself. But we have Mike Jacobs, who's the founder of the Dallas Holocaust Museum, who has a great work out there. We have video, for example, Max Glauben, who is one of our survivors that still speaks to school groups, has a great video. And then you can go broader. You can look at Elie Wiesel's work, you know, is on the number one, usually on most book club lists. His work, Night, is a very popular read, and most high schools read this work. There is a comparable work by Primo Levi, Survival in Auschwitz. And then from there, you can just browse. I always recommend people not only to come to our website, but maybe look at the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum's website, which has a great encyclopedia for further reading and research. It's, you know, I use it still sometimes too, is look up stuff. And they have great articles on different topics. So there's so many more
resources.
There's
also some stuff for younger children that I would suggest. There's Number of the Stars. There's When Hitler Stole Pink Rabbit. There's My Grandfather's Tattoo. In terms of movies, there's The Devil's Arithmetic. For older children, there's Defiance. There are, even for very young children, there's Dr. Seuss's Sneetches, which deals with little creatures with stars on their bellies and little creatures without stars on their bellies. And Dr. Seuss, Theodore Geisel, was himself very involved in anti-fascist cartooning during the war, so was very conscious of what he was doing. But this children's story is written specifically for young children, and it's a good kind of entree into the theme without scaring children. So,
Sarah Abosh is Senior Director of Education for the Dallas Holocaust Museum. Charlotte DeCoster is Education and Public Engagement Coordinator. You can see the exhibition Anne Frank, a private photo album, on display at the Dallas Holocaust Museum through March 31st. Find information at dallasholocaustmuseum.org. Ladies, thank you so much both for being here. Really appreciate it.
Our pleasure.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is senior producer. You can learn more about the show, find out about upcoming programs, and download the podcast at kera.org/think. You can email comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.